Welcome to Meeple, uniting players around the world. A 30-minute exploration of PJ and Gareth's four-game experiences from across both sides of the Atlantic. Each episode, they share their thoughts and opinions on the world of board games, including their favourite themes, games, hot topics, and much, much more.
Hey guys, and welcome to episode 57, An Obsession with Obsession. That's right, this is the game you hear Gareth and I talk about constantly. We're going to talk about Obsession. We've got a special guest for you, and always, I'm PJ.
And I'm Gareth.
And Gareth, this is going to be an amazing episode, is it not?
I got to say, it's pretty special. I mean, we've talked about this game far too much. Our listeners know there is an obsession with Obsession.
Even if we don't talk about Obsession, we squeeze it in.
We have we have Dan Halligan, the designer of Obsession, live with us on the show today.
That's right.
Welcome, yeah. Dan.
Thank you. Glad to be here. That's a little bit of pressure.
No, it's fine. You are amongst friends and probably family at this point, I think.
So, Dan, for those who don't know about Obsession and maybe they're tuning into the episode for the first time, could you give us a very short overview of the theme and the mechanics in the game before we get into the questions that we've all got lined up for you?
Sure. So basically, back in the Industrial Revolution, there was a real stress going on with the landed aristocracy, that there were now options for their primary source of income, which was tenants. They basically owned a lot of land and they gathered a lot of money from that. And they now had options in the cities working. That's really was the explosion of the cities back in that time frame, and that put a lot of them into a financial pinch. And so what would happen with these massive manor houses or country estates, every room needed a fire set, every room needed candles, you needed literally an army of servants to keep it clean and to keep it functional. And so you would start shutting off parts of your estate, might be 60,000-70,000 square feet, and you're closing off wings, and you're basically circling the wagons, you will, against this financial crisis. So that's the start of the game, and that is that. For I don't dive into this, but all our families have come into a source of income.
Yeah,
and they want to try to reverse that trend and see if they can capture a little bit of the glory days, if you will. And
absolutely.
So you start very humbly with only a few spaces represented by tiles, only a few servants represented by your starting servants, only a few friends represented by your starting hand. And you're going to try to basically mechanically manage the dance between servants, reputation, available activities you can host, and guests that will be willing to come to those activities. And everything else is sort of around that. And it sort of accelerates as you build combos, and there's a little courtship mixed in, but I think maybe that's enough of an overview, or do you want more?
No, that's good. I got to say, I'm going to pick up one bit, the dance. Dance in the Grand Ballroom. It really is. It's a wonderful dance between that balancing the hand, trying to get your construction, your estate developed, and having the right servants and the teams to support you.
Absolutely. Yeah, how many times have we said, "Oh, I can't do that."
Yeah, I wanted that, and somebody else has taken the servant that you were going to kindly hire for your estates. It is a dance is a fantastic word, and it really is a dance.
That's a great description, right?
Thank you.
Single word description of an amazing game, dance.
Oh man,
thank you.
And I can't remember when you broke into top 100, but we definitely commented that week. I think you're now at 83 of the best board games of all time in the Board Game Geek rank, and Thematics 23. How does that feel as a as an achievement?
That's like I went out and started shooting baskets in the driveway, and then the Detroit Pistons, who I grew up watching, walked up and signed me. It's so beyond the expectations of what I started, which was to publish a boutique game that maybe I could make a couple hundred copies and give them away when they hit the bin out front in Barnes and Noble, you know, where they're trying to get rid of inventory. So I had no expectations except to try to sort of just get my toe into the industry and have fun with it, because I was ending a career. I retired at 59 and had a very successful career. So I was looking for a hobby, and the hobby, as my brother says, it's the game that ate my brother. The hobby has turned into a lot of fun work.
That's amazing story. And how long ago did you start designing Obsession until the point you did the first Kickstarter? How long was that journey?
Well, since I was working up until 2022, and the first idea to do something was like 2015.
Okay.
There was a very slow ramp up. There was a lot of crafts, you know, home crafts, where I'm cutting out pieces from cray paper and drawing things and just goofing around. So until it got serious was probably 2016. I pursued it a little more aggressively, and then that led to the 2017 boutique Kickstarter, the first edition. And then when that became successful, however we want to define that, then it sort of became every weekend, most evenings, and it sort of took over a little bit. And then retirement allowed me to unretire the next day and take up game design.
That's a pretty good retirement. Because I was saying, I just went back and looked at the Kickstarter number one, so 2017, I think it was $36,000 and 645 backers. Which, you know, you accelerate that to the, you're on Kickstarter at the moment with the character expansion. It's already at $193,000 and over 5,000 backers. What a journey. Did you have any idea that it would get this response?
No, I mean, I would say, you know, every milestone I sort of marked like, wow, you know, I got in the top 500, I got in the top 1,000. But what I noticed was that there was a concept I had, which is completely sort of internally self-contradictory, which was a complicated gateway game. And the idea was to create a Trojan horse for people who love complicated, put that inside the horse and put a theme on the outside for the people they're trying to recruit who don't like complicated, but like a certain theme. So that seems silly, like it wouldn't work, but it was to make the medicine palatable, the complex mechanics for the people by giving them the theme that they wanted. Because I made it for my wife, I made it for my sister-in-law. For they don't want to be a swarmling, they don't want post-apocalyptic, they don't want to play 51st state, they don't want any of that. And so this was to give some of the same kind of mechanics you find in a Euro, but give them a theme that they're going to say, well, an English garden, you know, a duke, you know, and then they'd get drawn into it.
That's really interesting, Dan. My wife and I were talking about this very thing earlier today. What do you think it is about your game, having said everything you just did, that has made your game so popular amongst gamers who have just embraced this game and the theme 100%? Is there anything that you've observed that you think might explain that?
Well, I think it's that puzzle, that dance that keeps the gamer engaged.
Yeah.
There's a real dangerous sort of line I crossed, which is the use of randomness in order that person you're recruiting isn't automatically going to get waxed playing a game with you. I mean, I'm sitting in a room like you, surrounded by games. We all have a sort of a strange ability to assimilate all these rules for the games we love. And when you pull out a game and you know every rule in a 24-page rule book, all they think is you're just going to, I feel like inadequate in this setting, just as if, you know, she's an extra expert tennis player and drags me onto court and I don't know how to play. It seems like no fun. Where we see the magic, they see intimidation. And so I put enough randomness into it that I can lose to a first-time player and have many times. I played a lot of obsession because the horns of Victorian fate decided they were going to do a number on me. So that was necessary. If you make a game that's like an Uwe Rosenberg game, doesn't matter about the theme, they're going to hate it because they're just not going to be able to get the wood like in Agricola.
Yeah.
You know, you're just going to shut them out. Period. It's all over. And that they're not going to find that fun. I talked about the analogy. I used to play a ton of Terra Mystica, and I don't play it so much anymore except for nostalgia. Because if I could sort of weasel getting the halflings in the board draft, and I got a dig bonus in like the third round, no one could beat me. Just as I couldn't beat anybody who got the same combo and knew what they were doing. And so when you have perfect information and you have experts going against amateurs, it's not a formula for evangelizing our hobby. And so this was intended to sort of leave that risk that even that first-time player could knock one out of the park.
Mm. Yeah, I mean, a number of times I've played the game where with someone sneak the win at the end, or it's just been lining up all the combos, and then suddenly it's bam, 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 bam. They've taken a ton of points, and job done. I mean, it does work really well for new players and old. I love that Trojan horse description, mm-hmm. because I think I've said this on the show before. I'd completely missed the first Kickstarter, and it wasn't until it went to fulfillment on the second one that suddenly I was like, everyone's talking about this game. I need to find a bit more about it. Picked up a copy. I think I went all in and just grabbed everything that was available. And then, so since then we've played it with new gamers, old gamers. It's been in regular rotation with a whole multitude of players. So I think it works a treat embracing new gamers, old and new.
Absolutely.
Fantastic.
Absolutely. So, I got to ask, Dan, what was your inspiration for the way you put it in your current Kickstarter project, your video at the beginning? You were like, break the rules, right? That concept of breaking the rules. Like, what was the inspiration behind that? It seems like you really are a rule breaker with this whole project.
Well, I'm blessed by the fact that I don't have to make a bottom line.
Yeah.
And I don't even I only take what my accountant says is a salary I have to take, so the IRS doesn't look at me with a skanky eye, you know. So so given that ability, I have different margins that I'm able to work at than other companies. So I don't want to imply that other companies, like, I'm looking behind you at a couple of games, you know, I have and I like. Those companies got dozens of people, and they've got designers, and they've got, from, you know, marketing people who go to the conventions. They got a whole team to pay. I have me and my cat Duchess Lilo is in my lap and nothing else. And so that gives me the ability to break those rules. And so I didn't need, if I had offered a bundle of obsession for all the games plus the expansion plus the coins, I could have probably done a $700,000-$800,000 Kickstarter, but I don't need to do that. And it dovetails with the fact that it wouldn't be very ethical to tell all the people who bought inventory from me to sell that, hey, I'm going to take over for a while and you just go ahead and keep your inventory company in that warehouse, and then we'll, you know, eventually you'll get some interest back in the product. That just, what it doesn't dovetail with what I want to do, having fun and doing the right thing. And so that's the breaking of the rules. The other is just not to do anything marketing related. I mean, I think I am so fatigued by Kickstarters that in the first 3 seconds of a lead video, I most time I turn it off because it's got Ken Burns effects on woodland creatures with a narrator, and they're just trying to all sort of capture, you know, you get a wingspan. Well, we're going to have this bird game, or we're going to have this animal. You get an Ark Nova, we're going to have these animals here. We're going to do this. You get, you know, a tapestry. You're going to have this Roman game or this building game. They just try to throw the bling, and there's a lot of good stuff out there. A lot of times it is to just try to get on that bandwagon for a particular theme that's of interest. Like I just saw, I don't know if it's a good game or not, but it's a game looks very much like Quacks of Quedlinburg, which I like a lot. It's perfect for a certain audience, but there's one out there now which looks got the same circle and it's got the same components and same spell thing. And I see a lot of that. And I don't get a lot of people explaining to me what's special about the project, why they're I'll tell you a story. Right. I was at a convention and I was on a panel of designers with some other people on that panel, and somebody who wanted to design a game came in and said, what kind of game should I make to get it sold to a company and become a designer? And wow. I said, mm-hmm. Dude, you can't think that way. Mm-hmm. I said, if you're not starting with your heart and soul behind something that's unique and passionate for you, I said, you'll never make it to the finish line.
Yeah.
I said, it's just too hard. If you're going to try to compete with a company that can do the same sort of cloning that you want to do as a guy in your basement, you're not going to keep up with them. I said, you got to find something that just stirs your drink and go with that thing from beginning to end. And when everybody says, no, that won't work, stick with it. Listen to the people, you know, and then tune it up. I mean, I make the point that without Rotto, I might have never been one to have a game because out of the blue, with a solicitation that was, you know, just came to him without any warning, he agreed to look at the game. And he basically told me, you got too much bloat on this thing. Trim it down. And that's when I got to the dance because I had events. I had people dying. You would lose cards. I had things like fire and war. I had the most complicated reconstruction of 19th century Pax Britannica that you could imagine. Yeah. It was too much. And so I, you know, cut it all out and we got to where we're at. So there's a blend between passion for your project and listening to the people who say, you know, you've got to fine tune some things.
And was it always Victorian England? Has that always been the theme, or was it that something you honed in later?
It was always 19th century Britain, but it started out as Romantic period or 1820s Jane Austen period. And the reason I moved it to 1860 was because the number one thing that I think frustrates a wannabe gamer that's not going to dump a lot of resources into something that's probably going to struggle to get anywhere is art.
Yeah.
You might've saw the lead video. I started to introduce a little bit of art there that's coming up in a later game for me next year. And that's expensive. You can't do that if you're just doing a boutique game. So then I landed on the idea of, because I knew I way back in another life when I was a young man, I worked microfilming and patent searching for the U.S. Patent Office as a private contractor. And I knew that all images before 1929 are in the public domain. Mm-hmm. So I said, well, here's a ton of material that I can use a little Photoshop and I can restore and I can, you know, create sort of a feel. And that was my way to work around that big investment for a boutique mm-hmm. game. And I forgot what we were talking about, but anyway.
Victorian England. But yes,
Victorian. Thank you very much. So the camera came around in the 1840s. I always butcher this word. I think it's the daguerreotype, which is those brown sepia tone pictures with the long exposure. Everybody looks like they're a cadaver. They sort of got a freeze and they got these funny looks on their face starting in there. And then in the 1860s, there was some more normal camera work and better photographs. And so I needed to get later because I'm not going to find any pictures back in Jane Austen's time.
Right.
It's amazing how many of those photographs, when we're playing the game, look like people we know today. I don't know whether you have that, PJ.
Oh, but yeah. We're
like, that looks like my boss, and this looks like my long-lost auntie. I mean, seriously, some of them very, very close. And, of course, we always announce our guests at the dinner table or the game table when they arrive.
That's proper practice.
So you did the original Kickstarter back in 2017. Then there was Upstairs, Downstairs, which was like a full-on expansion. And now we've got the characters expansion. How much work was it to get to this, I guess, this mix of set of cards? We've got some new meeples, we've got some new mechanics. How much was that already designed, or was that something that's happened over the last sort of 18 months or 2 years?
No, I mean, one of the things, so I talked about walking that line between perfect information and randomness and a serious gamer and a new gamer. I still am acutely aware that whenever you use randomness, 80% of the time it works out, 20% of the time you get that probability of a lot of bad things happening at once. Mm-hmm. If you think, for example, there's been times when the first five guests you draw are negative guests.
Yeah.
Feel a lot of times you can have some fun with that, but let's say you're not really invested in the theme. You feel like, come on. What kind of game is this? You know, and that in my mind, Upstairs, Downstairs, it was my first attempt to thematically address things that can get out of control by giving you servants to mitigate randomness.
Yeah.
And I had no thought of characters expansion until I continued to see people still having that sort of experience of that horrible first game when randomness just knocked them out. And so I thought, what if there was a way to do three things with an expansion? Number one, increase player interaction. Number two, to let people do a sort of a cost-benefit analysis on whether or not they would be willing to give up this profitable thing to solve that problem that they see looming on the horizon.
Right.
And then lastly was to make it lean and mean and fit in the box, because I know just how infuriating it is when you have a box perfectly tricked out and then something comes along and you like it and now you're on two boxes. So I wanted to not, for example, I killed the idea of doing a number of tiles. First of all, I think there's enough tiles in the bag. I don't think you need to keep going on the tiles.
Absolutely.
And secondly, the punch boards are a big space hog when you get the tiles and everything comes with. So I killed off, I was going to have some tiles, which allowed you to personalize your family more. So every family would start with six tiles and Wessex would start with seven.
Oh, okay.
And it would give you a special space. It was a solar, I'm not sure which, probably a solar. And there was a hunting box for the young, and everyone had an affiliation with a particular family member.
Right.
So the young lady was in the solar, the young man, the heir was in the hunting box, had that as his personal, the hunting box being a small cabin in the woods, if you will, where you would go to hunt. But I'm sure it wasn't old cabin in the woods for those folks, but but that was too much. That was too much. It wasn't going to fit in the box. So I got to the sideboard. But the mitigation piece here is different than the servants, because the servants is sort of small mitigation. And the characters expansion deals with big mitigation,
mm-hmm.
which was the last four things I identified as big mitigation was getting stuck with objectives that you're just dead in the water. You can't get them.
Yeah, that's great.
Secondly was not being able to dip into that prestige guest deck, which is going to always – it's very rare if you only get, 10, 15 points in a prestige guest category that you're going to win.
Yeah.
The next one was to deal with the red hand of death, which is all those unsavory guests loading up in your hand, which is the constable. So the reverend takes care of the first, The dowager takes care of the second. The constable takes care of the third. And then there's the supply of servants. They're not servants with references, but they're servants that can help you use the West Saloon on the last, on the second from last round in order to pull off a huge thing because, you know, there's been a raid on ladies' maids or there's been some other thing that's gone on that's left you short on service and you're just stuck.
I got to say that all of them I smiled at in terms of you can see the games I've played when one of those points has caused me to lose, you know, the red hand of death, particularly trying to get the right servants. So the fact that I can hire in, you know, more clumsy, maybe less well-spoken servants.
Right. But and a thought on that is that I'm not running away from those unsavory guests. I think that's one of the most thematic things. So in the cards that are coming, I am loading up a whole lot more. I increase my percentage from 14 to 17% of guests in the casual deck are now Red Hand of Death guests.
Amazing.
But you have the constable there to allow you to deal with it. And one thing I did that I don't think, I wouldn't change it now because I think they represent sort of a curveball, but I think the key to a good unsavory guest is disappointment that that guest is in your hand somewhat, but not altogether because they give you some benefit that you really can use. The American Heiress is the classic example of that.
One of my favorites, that one. if you play it right, Sorry, go on.
You pull that American Heiress with 800 in the first draw, you're dancing a jig at the table, man. You're going to just go on a shopping spree.
There's been a few of those games when that's come out in my first hand or second hand. And it's been genius.
And I've added industrialists, which are British heiresses, if you will, but they're the same mechanic, right? A little less hit on the reputation and not quite the same amount of money. But I've added scoundrels that you're able to expand your activities, number of people. They're almost like a carriage house, if you will. Mm-hmm. And so all these things, every unsavory guest that I have put in there comes with really desirable favors as well as a punishing negative at the end. So you've got to manage. And this is where the interaction comes in, because some people think that obsession has without this character's expansion, think that obsession has worker placement, but it doesn't. We have workers and we place them, but they're not competitive spaces. So it's really an action selection mechanism.
Yeah.
This is worker placement on the sideboard. And it's worker placement that takes two turns. It takes one turn to place and one turn to clear. Right. And you have a lot of desire to use the sideboard in maybe the last six rounds. And so you have some intense timing decisions to make, because I played one time where I loaded up on the Red Hand of Death and I had no problem with it. Even when I was drawing a screened casual with the lady of the house, I was pulling in that Elizabeth Jones who gives me a prestige guest with minus 200, right? I'm going to go ahead and take her. And I ended up getting stuck because everybody was beating me to my spot to get the constable. So there's still some tactics that go on there.
Sure.
But all the new guests, there's no duds. There's a couple duds in the original where the pauper, you know, costs you 200 and gives you one invite or something. You go, what am I going to do with that? So that is a key thing with the increasing the player interaction. And the other thing was to try to make the pass turn as fun as possible.
Right.
In the first game or the base game, it's torture.
Yep.
You don't even get to hire.
Yeah.
In the upstairs, downstairs, it got a boost because you could now hire on a pass. And here, you got the whole schmear. You go to the sideboard, you can hire, you can get your benefits. And only with the dowager do you give up those benefits. So it really makes the pass turn dynamic.
Who doesn't like a schmear, though, right?
And is there any change on the playtime? So is it a longer game now, or is it still, because we always found it relatively, I say fast, but it doesn't drag.
There'll be a little AP when you're learning it, but yeah. No, because brilliant. One of the things I did not want to do, I have gotten so many expansions where it changes something I like.
Yeah.
I will give you two examples. I had a couple playtesting groups where I had reported out that there was just a Donnybrook of a game, tight game, down to the wire. And both people that won minimally or not at all used the sideboard.
Right.
And the reason was I consider the sideboard Victorian urgent care. If you've got a problem, you're going to go to the sideboard. If you're humming along, the opportunity cost of giving up what your engine can support to go over to the sideboard isn't worth a small increment in victory points as you do your calculations. So, you know, you're shopping for objectives. Well, if you got great objectives, you don't need to see that reverend. If you don't have negative guests, or you got a French garden play where you're going to play that backside on round 18 or something, mm-hmm. you don't need that. If you're in the prestige desk, you don't need the dowager, then you should work your core engine. So the only time that you've got any additional game length to it would be is if someone's agonizing over whether they need to go to the doctor right now. Okay. Do I need to go to urgent
sure,
care?
Sure.
And what I try to tell people when I teach is I say, just have sort of like a little finger on the health of your objectives, on the health of your deck, on the health of your servant situation. And when you get a little nervous, then you want to, when you're not, it's not your turn, you're watching other people. You want to start looking at those objectives on the sideboard. You want to start asking yourself the question, all right, is it worth it? And that shouldn't add too much to the game time, if anything at all.
Honestly, that dance just got better, isn't it? I mean,
I'm
excited just listening about it. Just I can think about all those different decisions that I've got to decide, but brilliant.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. Hey, a little more about the sideboard real quick. Where did you get the names for Constable Bucket and Reverend Grantley? Like, where are those names? Where are those, like, Constable Bucket? That just seems so strange to me.
So in Bleak House, a Dickens novel, there yep. is a Constable Bucket who ultimately solves the mystery. The idea that I was leaning at, I was also going to name the Dowager, but I couldn't find a Dowager that sort of fit the profile, so I made her the eccentric Dowager. I had one gentleman, and I'm going to even mention his name, David Buckland, who from the very first Kickstarter saved me from a lot of faux pas, because I'm still an American. I still don't know it like the natives, and like particularly trying to figure out entails and who's named what and all. Mm-hmm. You know, he really helped me on that. And he recommended a Dowager, and she escapes me now. Very well known, but I looked into her and read up on her a little bit, and she didn't fit the eccentric, wealthy Dowager that I had. So I just went with the eccentric Dowager. Plus, she never appears as a meeple. Really, it's the people who are living at her house. Another thing in Bleak House, in Bleak House, which is an actual country estate, there's like a weird dude who's just living in the house. He's not related. He never leaves. He doesn't have any money. He eats dinner there every day. No one asks him to leave. And there's some other examples of that in Victorian literature. And I said, I'm just going to make like a halfway house for rich people in this Dowager's castle. And so I put all these political refugees in there because, you know, when you're running into trouble over on the continent, you basically want to get on that island where you're going to be nice and safe. And and I throw a few other people in there. So that was Constable Bucket. The Dowager wasn't named. Barchester Towers, which is an Anthony Trollope novel.
Right.
Okay.
What has Reverend Grantley. And he was a prominent reverend that I recalled. There's really not a firm link to what they're doing for us in our game and their literature background, their literary background. It's just me sort of putting a little flavor on them. And that's true of everything. I mean, I take a lot of things I shouldn't take, like the name York or Cavendish, which have a certain history
yeah.
in England, and throw them into rural Derbyshire as just an ordinary family. I go with the sort of attractive elements of that era and incorporate them into a stew, if you will, so that we can use them. And Higby's for the servants, I just made up because it sounded like an oily proprietor who was trying to pawn off bad servants.
certainly being English, that even just choosing the family, whether we randomly draw it or we pick them, it just the moment you open a box and the theme is just oozing. It's absolutely brilliant. You've talked about the cooperative mode on the Kickstarter. Is there anything you can share about co-op mode?
Yes.
I spent all day today. And trying to figure this out because I'm in a, you know, so I've written in the past a few things and I've gotten writer's block. And anybody who's written anything, you get writer's block. And then you get times where you just, it's all flowing. And I had writer's block, if you will, designer's block for the co-op mode, because all I had was what I had designed back in 2018. Yep. It's just something I was spitballing. And I really spent some time with it, and then just the floodgates opened, and I'm right behind me. I'm looking at the new board I came up with for the family that you'll be testing against. And the problem is that I'm in a boa constrictor of time. I've got 9 days left. I'm going to be revealing a tile designed by Tony Boydell of Snowdonia fame.
My favorite designers too.
And he's got one that's good. So there is one little punch board, like the little one that comes in the useful box or the Wessex expansion or the promos. Mm-hmm. And I'm offering what was in the useful box with this game just because I need to close that out. That was a small run game. So I'm giving people the business room and the redesigned West Terrace. I don't know if you have those.
Sure do.
And there's two squares left. And Tony contacted me. Amazing. And says, I really want to do this. And I said, bring it on, baby. So I'm going to be doing that early in the week. And then I've got some solo content that I need to roll out because Obsession Solo has been way beyond my expectations successful as a solo game. And
absolutely.
So I've got some solo content that I have to get out. And I'm getting this pressure of getting the co-op to a finished state before I go to print. Because one of the things I want to do, and I think is a big mistake that designers or publishers make in a Kickstarter, is they don't get on the serious business of having your files validated by the pre-press specialists at the publishers or at the manufacturer. Until they get the Kickstarter done.
Right.
And that can be a 3-month process.
Mm-hmm.
And then people find out that their target date of September becomes a year and a half later.
Oh yeah.
And my files are done. And then what happens is changes emerge from the Kickstarter. Like I'm changing the color of the carriage. We had a nice little discussion on that.
Yeah.
And it's a plug and play change and I get right to my print. So even in 2020, which I made a mistake on the promise date, but I still got it done in 11 months in a COVID year.
It's incredible.
And one month was spent watching my freighter sit off the coast of East Coast trying to get into the port. So,
oh, Lord. Yep.
I want to deliver this thing quick because I just think that's an important part of credibility when you do a Kickstarter is they look back and they say, did he deliver something quickly? Yeah, he delivered it quickly. So I want to do that. And if I go down the rabbit hole of this co-op, I'm worried I'm going to delay it. So just to answer the reveal stuff that you might be looking for, most people don't know the on the back of a napkin co-op I did 5 years ago. So basically it is there you collaborate with. So let's say the two of you are playing a game of Obsession co-op. You two are on the same side. your two families. You pick them out of the box as per normal. You get the ability to share resources. So your guests, Gareth, can go over to his estate.
Yeah.
You can loan servants back and forth. You can loan starter guests to finish out an activity or something. You can give 100 to 200 pounds back and forth. You coordinate your objectives. So you're fully collaborative. And you're going against an evil, I use as the prototype Warlegen from Poldark. I don't know if you've ever seen Poldark.
Oh, yeah. My wife's a huge fan.
Yeah, he's a diabolical sort of late to money type of mercantile guy. Well, this is, I call him the Sneyd, S-N-E-Y-D, Sneyd. And they got a little bit of an evil overtone, but they're not. They're just diabolical in their actions. And they're very hard to beat, extremely hard to beat. And what you do is you have a really good tactical and strategic view because you're running the AI. And the AI is a full game. So, for example, every time that the Automa buys a tile from the market, that goes into the Sneyd tableau and flips to the rose side, and every benefit on the front side goes to your opponent. So if they buy the cricket field and that flips into, they get that money from that cricket field.
Wow.
So they're generating resources. And then every prestige guest is kept in a tableau. And as their reputation climbs, how does it climb? When they buy prestige tiles, it gets flipped, their reputation climbs. And there's an AI that prefers certain types of tiles, one to the other. And when they hit the level of a tableau where you have your prestige guests as Sneyd, they fire those guests and you get their favors and then they go into the deck. So they're very difficult to beat. And the only way you can beat them, only way, is by collaborating. You got to basically talk about it constantly. It's like when you're playing a game of Pandemic Legacy.
Yeah.
I mean, you're sitting there just saying, you got to go take care of those cities over there. You know, you got to quarantine those faded because this is a problem. And you got to have those types of conversations. Like, if he gets that in the market because it's a courtship tile and the AI prioritizes that, we're going to give him that French garden. He's going to get two prestige guests, which will go in his tableau. And so I'm working on this whole thing, but it's not at the level of being finished enough to not push back my timeline. So I'm actually going to probably put out an update this week where I tell people that if I can do the rule book as a PDF and just go with production, then I can make the timeline.
Nice.
If you want a rule book in the characters expansion for the co-op, then I'm going to hit Chinese New Year and I'm going to miss my target by probably 2 to 3 months. And I'm just going to sort of float that concept because I want to be on time. The reason I think that's palatable is in 2024, I'm going to steal something from Jamie Stegmaier, which is I'm going to do a consolidated rule book for all the expansions. And if you looked at the characters expansion rulebook, that was edited by a guy named Jeff Frazier, who is a rulebook expert.
Right.
And it's 1,000 times clearer than anything I've ever written, which I'm not a good rulebook writer. I'm a creative writer. I'm not a technical writer.
Different skill set. Yep.
Yep. He's going to take all my stuff that I vomited up over the last 5 years and he's going to put it in one rule book organized for easy access. And I can put the co-op into that in late 2024. And I think most people are going to end up getting that. I'll make it a free PDF. But if you want an actual physical copy, it'll probably be like, you know, 10, 12 bucks to get the physical copy, spiral bound, something like that.
Right. I think spot on. Yeah, I think that works. Yeah. Works for me. You get my vote.
The last interesting thing is your scoring as a team for you two.
Okay.
Is okay. Averaged tableau, averaged guests, lowest reputation. So you can't have a guy sacrifice his reputation for all the special actions to help out his buddy and go with somebody. So lowest reputation. objectives that you take your four best between the two of you or the three of you. And so you can work objectives. You know, you, for example, let's say you've got one of those big groups of 17 points, right?
Right.
You know, you can collaborate to get the money over to your partner that they can get that cricket field in order to complete that 17 point objective. And that's going to be a big deal because the one advantage you have over Snade is that he can't really manipulate his objectives. And so there's little subtleties like that. And then mostly everything is averaged. So you got to keep an eye on both your tableaus, both your decks. You got to keep an eye on everything that you're doing in order to beat them. And it's a lot of fun, but there's still a lot of rule work to go. The components are rounding into shape.
Okay.
One of my favorite things is it adds a second AI dice, which I call the propriety dice. And it's basically whenever Snade's Machiavellian tendencies you see behind Oz's curtain, and you see that he is being Machiavellian, and it gets out into the grapevine, he takes a hit.
Right.
Takes a hit in reputation and money and other things. One of the favorite things I have is that you're able to control your discard pile of casual guests, and whatever you choose to top deck, he ends up inheriting because he's a sleazeball. So you're going to basically try to control putting the worst guests on the top of the casual deck. And you can do that by using a servant's hall if you have it. Your gossip, instead of taking a point of reputation, allows you to push forward the worst guest to him under the guise that this would be a good friend for you guys. So a lot of clever things like that. Very thematic. And it consumes every breathing waking hour I have right now.
It just sounds like a lot of fun.
Yes, yes.
Yeah, I'm glad I'm not a game designer, though.
I'm obsessed with this game, and I'm a sucker for co-op.
He loves the co-op, doesn't he?
Oh, it's the marriage.
And it's so good for a new player, isn't it? You sit down with a co-op, you know, you don't have to alpha them. You can just sort of have the conversation, and things can hit. And then they'll want to play that competitive game later on.
Absolutely. You really can do a tango or dance with them.
I interrupt this podcast to share with you the word you need for the Get Into Games Obsession giveaway. The words are, the obsession is real. I repeat, the obsession is real. Normal broadcast commences.
It's literally all bands.
Nice.
I was going to say something. So one thing I think that point you made about there was a vote this week for the carriage color, and then you're talking about a vote for the PDF. I think one thing I've observed throughout my obsession journeys is just how connected and accessible you are, Dan. If I'm on a Board Game Geek thread and there's a question, I know that at some point in a second there'll be an answer.
Yes.
It's quite rare to see just how, I guess, in touch you are with the community.
It's common sense. The only thing, I'm terrified by somebody having a bad experience at Obsession because they can't figure out my labyrinthine rule book, you know? And so if somebody's like, I just had today, somebody came on and said, I just got this game. I don't know how to pack it. What do I do? So I got to jump on there and say, watch this. Oh, thank you so much. You know, why wouldn't I do that?
Yeah,
you know,
absolutely.
I will tell you this, and this, people might criticize the rankings as they work, but human nature is human nature. And if I was totally unplugged from my game, I don't think I'd be in the top 100.
Absolutely. Yeah. I agree completely.
I think people, if they have a better experience, that's common sense. And also if they respect that their support for the game are going to rate it better. I don't do it for that reason, but it's a nice dividend that if you stay engaged I don't want to say excuse, but an explanation for some companies that can't do that. You know, when you're Ryan Lockett and you've got all those games, you know, you can't run around and do that on all that, or you're a big operation. I'm a little worried that I'm a one hit wonder, you know, like Uriah Heep stealing when you could have been buying. That's the only song I know. so I've got other plans that not to be a one-hit wonder. I'd like to be a two-hit wonder by next year. We'll have to see.
Can you share anything about what's coming up? I know you've shown some artwork. What is coming into this world of Obsession or other games?
A trick-taking game in the Obsession universe. So the Obsession, as you know, has a tile, the front parlor, where it has a whist on the front. Yep. That's a classic trick-taking game. Yep. And for those of you who have emailed me and said you should not have a gambling parlor in the parlor, Casino is a trick-taking game. It's not a casino like in Las Vegas.
Right.
Yeah.
So I wanted to play a riff on that. So the name of the game is Parlor, and it's a trick-taking game, and it uses as the cards you play your gentry that fall into suits, and you're playing for the tiles that you have, which aren't tiles, which are cards. And the reason I have art for all of the Obsession tiles is because the cards are going to be the tiles, and you're going to basically play to build your estate instead of all the dance and the complicated mechanics. It's just a trick-taking game to acquire the cards, the spaces and the rooms that you want. And you're going to try to work it that way. So I was going to be kickstarting that now and doing characters next year. And I flipped the two because I wasn't where I wanted to be with Parlor. And I felt that characters was there. So I flipped the two. And then as soon as I get my files in with Panda, I'll switch to Parlor.
Right. And that's Kickstarter, what, this time next year or earlier?
I'm moving to Utah from Ohio.
Okay.
And I'm doing that in late February through March. I got to move my offices as well as my house. And so I probably don't think it's going to happen until this time next year.
Yeah, okay.
I'll try for sooner, but I don't think so because I'll have fulfillment that'll hit me.
Yeah, yeah.
And slow me down.
It's busy.
So, Dan, here comes the last question. It's probably the most probing question. It's going to have the most pressure on you. I always save these for last. Will there be, in the future, a playable version of Duchess Lilo in the game?
I was going to cut you off and say, I bet it's about my cat. Well, there's a variant in the variant catalog. So there's going to be, that's the other reveal I've got this week, a variant catalog.
Okay, yeah.
It's
okay.
20 pages. It's got a large number of just fan variant. Well, I'd say I maybe have about 40% of them, but a lot of them are inspired or collaborative variants, just variants that have been out there. And one variant I did come up with was a playable version of Duchess Lilo, which you keep her in the deck, you draw her, and whoever draws her gets a choice between, I think it is 100 pounds or one reputation. And then you display her with pride, and you get to replace her with a screened invite.
Nice.
So it's just a way to keep the cat in the game. And yep. I'm doing that from memory. I didn't come up with that, so I edited that. But I edited a lot of things recently. But so that would be as close as I think we're going to get to. Although I had someone who, shortly after she came out, said they legally played her. And really? I didn't think that was possible, but they pulled her into the Lionheart suite.
If you
sure. Every servant is not required.
Yeah. Yeah.
Damn. Yes. There is a way, PJ.
And that gets you 18 reputation.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes.
Right. So,
ooh.
That's
going
to be on my little list of things to achieve.
Really.
Right. So, Dan, thank you very much. It's been an absolute pleasure for myself and PJ to have you on Meeple to Meeple.
Thank you so much, man.
My pleasure. A lot of fun.
Okay. Thank you for listening, everybody. And we'll be back with more Obsession-themed content, no doubt, soon. Thanks, Dan. Thanks, PJ.
Thank you, gentlemen.
Thanks, everyone, for listening. Please subscribe. And as always, we love to hear your thoughts and ideas. So make sure to leave those in the comments. And don't forget, you can also chat with us both on Instagram @MeepleToMeeple.